The right sheets can take your sleep and your style to the next level. With Boll & Branch, the upgrade has never been more affordable. Every set is crafted from 100% organic cotton. They get softer and softer over time. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews, and even three U.S. presidents have Boll & Branch sheets. Try them for 30 nights, and if you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. Go to BollandBranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free U.S. shipping with promo code CARTOON. Spelled B-O-L-L and Branch.com. That's BollandBranch.com, promo code CARTOON.
Hi, I'm Mackenzie Atwood, and this is our final episode of Steven Selects, a mini-series focusing on some of the fan-favorite and pivotal episodes of Steven Universe. But don't worry, it's not the end of the Steven Universe podcast. We've definitely got more in store for you, and sooner than you think. But today, to close out the special mini-series, we're doing a deep dive on Off Colors, the episode that introduced Steven's healing tears, showed us two sides of Homeworld, and also debuted the now-fan-favorite Pad Paracha.
Everyone!
What?
A wondrous vision has appeared before me. The twins of Rutile will bring one, no, two, strangers to our current place of hiding.
So Steven Universe writers Ben Levin and Matt Burnett join us once again. It's great to have you guys back again. Thank you guys so much for coming on and talking to me.
No problem. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
For sure. So this one is Off Colors. This is a big game-changing episode. How did it change from when you guys first conceived it to the final product?
Well, there were several changes.
Yeah, there was. Before it was even written, there was a lot of debate of where the episode would end, of where we were going to cut it off.
Right.
It's would it end with Lars dying and then be a sad cliffhanger, or would it be he gets resurrected and you're just like, whoa? And I think we ultimately, by the time we had gotten to the premise, we had had him be resurrected at the end, because it's sort of like, it's a cliffhanger that if we had held it to the next episode, it then immediately gets resolved. So, yeah, and it just, and it felt very, even for us, a little down.
Right.
To end with him dead. So, yeah, that was one change.
Yeah, yeah. And there were also, originally there were going to be two extra off colors named Flint and Chert.
They were quartz, they were like gray quartz soldiers who had a moral objection to fighting.
Yeah,
that's so cute. And so when we, I love that.
Yeah, they were fun ideas. But so when we did the handout, I think we were talking about like, look, what do you guys think? Is this too many off colors, like too many characters to deal with? And also there's this conversation about how I feel like they fit into off colors, because I think that the off colors represent different ways of being rejected by Homeworld society. And we realized that mostly it was about being rejected for who they were in a way that they couldn't change.
Right.
And Flint and Chert represented being rejected for like an intellectual idea, taking a stance. But we wanted this, you know, to really focus, because I think, you know, the Rutile twins, Road Knight, Fluorite, Pad Paracha, they represent different aspects of being, your being being rejected, just who you are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it felt more thematic to just keep it to them.
Yeah. They were cool, but yeah, they just didn't fit. And there's like enough characters to fit and frame, and one of them is the size of like a building. So,
yeah,
you know, it's okay.
Yeah.
You're off color, just like the rest of us.
What do you mean, off color?
You know, wrong, not right. Flawed.
When you were coming up with the group, so did you, you mentioned how you came up with them all together. Does it change, like, when you're conceiving these characters as a group versus when you're thinking up characters individually? Like, how they're going to work together versus just, like, how a character is?
Well, again, I think we were thinking of, like, what are different, how can we show a glimpse of who is rejected from Homeworld? You know, well, let's try and think of different ways. And so the Rutile twins, they emerged differently. Road Knight is this fusion, like Garnet, like a cross-class fusion that is just very, you know, taboo to them. Fluorite is a polyamorous fusion, and Pad Paracha functions differently. So they're all like, quote-unquote, not normal, ways of being not normal in a Homeworld society. So we're thinking of how, yeah, what were the different ways you could possibly be different here?
Yeah, and really, I mean, they all have familiar aspects of things we've seen gems do before, but it's just like super heightened and really pushed to show like how different and stuff gems can be, choose to be, and who and everything. So we really wanted to just show an even bigger look at the spectrum of the ways that gems can be outside of the way that Homeworld wants them to be.
Yeah, I think it was a really good look at that. Pat Parasha was like an instant fan favorite character. There's so many memes about it. What was her development like? And also, how do you guys manage to make her repetition, like, it's adorable and it's not really aggravating, which is something that I feel like would be a line you have to toe?
You know, we had to establish, you know, these four characters pretty quickly and give them traits that made them memorable. And so each of them has a characteristic that shows, you know, the way they're talking. Like, the twins have this repetition thing. Fluorite is constantly consulting with the many different gems, so she's very slow. Rhodonite is this reverse garnet, so she's, like, the pearl side of freaking out is showing. And then Pat Paracha has this, you know, future speak that we had to really work to track. It was always like, we got to make sure she's reacting late and that she's not, like, the way she's reacting is, you know, proper. And
yeah, it was a very, like, line by line, like, does this work for the, you know, the game that she's playing, that the character plays, of, like, saying it just after it happens. We had to, like, make sure that, I think early on it was a little bit like, is she just predicting obvious things or is she predicting things that already happened? And we had to kind of just, like, pick a direction with her and make sure she was always hitting it.
I think the thing that makes her, why people love her, is because she's very earnest and sincerely trying to help. And she comes in fully believing, my friends don't know this. You have to know this amazing thing's going to happen to Lars. Like, she's just always genuinely like, I have great news for you all. Or I have, oh, we have to do something. I think just her sincerity is, I think, why I love her.
Yeah.
It's wholesome. Wholesome. She's doing her very best.
Yes.
Something incredible is going to happen to Lars.
One other thing I thought about with this episode is that, like, you know, in the trial and then going into Off Colors, we see two totally different sides of Homeworld, where it's like one of them is like the, you know, the side that the diamonds see, which is like a prettier side of Homeworld. We just get a little glimpse of that. But, like, then we see sort of like the underbelly of Homeworld. So, like, what was it like planning to make these episodes Homeworld's debut after so much buildup?
Well, I think that, like, we couldn't show everything all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's better to Homeworld still has a lot to reveal to itself, to people. So, again, you get, like, just glimpses of everything. You get a glimpse as they break out of the trial of the skyline, and then you get a glimpse of what it's like in the depths and the core of the planet being eroded by all these different kindergartens underneath it. But you're never, like, seeing a whole picture. It's a benefit to both allow people to want to see more and also not kill us on a design level.
Yeah, I mean, it was a practical choice. Like, there was in the outline at the beginning of Off Colors, when they come out of the palanquin and they find themselves out on the streets of Homeworld, like, initially it was going to be like they land in a populated square, like, and that there are bystanders around. And then when the drones come and attack, they actually wind up poofing a bunch of bystanders and trying to get Steven and Lars. But it sort of is like, I think we've said it before in talking about episodes, like, we want to focus in on what matters about the episode. And this episode is very much about Lars and Steven and then the Off Colors and, like, the tension of them being in a place and being confused and not knowing, like, this is a totally different place for them. They're totally out of their element, and really, like, making it unfamiliar and making sure everything you see is, like, very quick glimpses of things and hints, but, like, they're on the run, so they don't have time to take any of this in. And
yeah, I think that, like, now what's fun about it is that you've got the highest high and the lowest low, and this is just as, like, deep as you can go in Homeworld. You know, you're at the street level where it's like you're under an overpass, a highway overpass, and just, I think the fact that there's no one there makes it even scarier, that they're just like, who could possibly help us? Oh no, these robots are after us. What are we going to do? And then someone beckons them. I think if there were people around, I mean, other gems around, it might feel less like, it might feel more chaotic, but maybe less like scary and hopeless of,
right.
You know?
Yeah, that kind of becomes familiar if it's like, oh, I land in a populated city. It's on another planet, but in a way that's familiar. But, you know, this feels very, we want it to feel very disorienting and stressful for them.
Right.
So we decided to hold on to some of that stuff for another day.
Keep wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. So one thing that Rebecca has talked a lot about is that there was always an idea to do the Lars character arc.
Yeah.
So what was it like tackling that in these episodes? And like, were there any tough decisions? You mentioned the one about the cliffhanger. What was it like just going into that?
I mean, I feel like we all were like, well, we finally earned this. Because I think that, yeah, there was the idea of
one of the
super
initial ideas was to kill Lars.
Yeah.
Like, he was going to just, like, it was just going to be a tossed off, like, oh, no, like, a monster attacks and a rock falls on Lars. And then Steven saves him.
Yeah, it was basically like, yeah, I know we've probably talked about this, but, you know, basically I can't remember the episode name, but you know, the one where Steven learns about his healing powers, like that would be kind of where we would have done it. There was an idea about pink lemonade being into it too. Like Steven was selling pink lemonade, and then there's a thing where Lars turns pink at the end.
Oh.
Like there was like different ideas flowing around way early on about this. But again, like for people who are creative and want to write stories, like there's a lot of things you want to do right away that you need to earn, you know, and you need to feel like you've learned enough about these characters and brought them to a place where making like their deaths and resurrections mean something. We have to spend a lot of time with them.
Right. And you know, as it became apparent that like this was going to be a change in Lars's character, I think we really wanted to be able to have the time to explore all the assets of Lars when he's really still got a lot to learn, and we got to do that, and we really got to see him as a character and sort of like all of his problems, all of his issues that he just can't get out of his own way. He's so obsessed with fronting and putting up this appearance of being like a really cool kind of typical tough guy, and he's just not that kind of guy. And then letting us see that side of him, and then getting to see the other side of him where he can be nice, he's interested in baking. And we really get to see all of that and see how it all comes together. And then when we did this moment with him where he finally like accepts that it's okay to be afraid, and then ultimately becomes braver than he's ever been in the series. Like it just really felt earned. You got like such a he was a more fully formed character.
We had to bring him to that low place for him to start rising up again. And so the potluck and the abandoning Sadie on the ship as well, like we're just our final, like we brought him down and then stuck together. He's just low, and now he's on an alien planet and it's just hopeless, and he just has all the regrets in his life he could ever have, and he's just tired of it, and he's I'm not going to be afraid anymore. So you need to bring him to that low so that it makes sense that he would do something so brave and big and different.
Yeah.
You can't get much lower than being dead, so that totally makes sense.
Lars!
I didn't think we were going to make
it. That was amazing!
Lars,
you
that was
amazing!
So
we're winning! We're winning!
So when Steven heals Lars, it's his tears that do it, and I remember that being a... You were talking about that episode where he learns about his healing powers. I think it's called An Indirect Kiss.
Right.
And... Yeah, so that was like a whole thing. So does that mean that he had the tears the whole time, he just didn't know how to access them?
Probably. I think that, you know, there's a certain point in the series where it feels like Steven has control over his powers, you know, and that's so it's something he has, but there's never, we haven't killed anyone until this point, so it's never presented itself as a thing.
Yeah, I think his powers are growing, and so that sort of manifests itself. Because this wasn't done on purpose, though. He just is crying, and then there's so much emotion behind it. I think that's when it really, that's why it works.
Mm-hmm.
Was that another thing you felt like you had to earn, you think? Like the powers?
Oh, the powers of being able to do this?
Yeah,
I guess
like
so.
The build-up.
Yeah.
It kind of makes him OP.
Again, like from the other side, like of healing, resurrecting a character not meaning enough. And also, if Steven did this in episode two, if he did this in episode two, it would feel so overpowered.
Then you're just like, I mean, it sort of like cuts out a lot of the stakes of a lot of situations with other characters, if you think that, like, oh, Steven can just bring them back to life, it's not necessarily that he can just, like, fire off this power at will. You know, we don't know that yet.
Yeah.
But I think that if it is, like, it becomes Dragon Ball at that point, if, you know, you can just bring back a character, like, it removes a little bit of the tension, I think. So, yeah.
One other thing I was thinking about, and this is something that people have asked, what do you think would happen if, like, Lars tried to go inside Lion's mane? Like, from the outside of Lion. Is that what do you think would go down?
Oh gosh, I gotta make a diagram. I don't know. Can he if Lars
Escher
went inside Lion's mane? I don't know. He could probably stick his head in there, but then he couldn't come out himself.
Yeah, maybe his tree. Maybe his tree just wouldn't. No,
I don't know.
Maybe he could go in and he just couldn't peek out in the same way that he can't go through.
Right.
Yeah. That's a tough question. It's a tough question.
I don't know.
It definitely would be difficult, whatever it is.
Maybe he just can go. He goes into Lion's Mane, and then if he goes in at his side of things, he just Russian nesting dolls himself. And then it's just he just enters the quantum realm. He's going in deeper and deeper. It's Inception. And then he just has to continually crawl out of levels of his mind until he can then crawl out a lion. that's canon.
Yeah, or that's his way of cloning himself.
If he can climb
in lion and pop out his own head, he pops out, and now there's two of them. And then we do a multiplicity.
Finally got another donut boy.
Yes, yeah. Then they can be multiple Lars everywhere.
That would be something. Okay, cool. Thank you guys so much for coming on and talking to me.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for having us.
And like I promised, Rebecca Sugar is answering some of the questions that you guys tweeted to me at MK Atwood and to the official Cartoon Network Twitter. And we also have former Steven Universe executive producer and the creator of OKKO, Ian Jones-Cordy, answering questions too. So we'll have Ian take a few and then we'll turn it over to Rebecca. And Ian Jones-Cordy is here with me and ready to answer some questions. Thank you so much for doing this.
Of course.
So we have some fan questions. First up is one from Lincoln Prime, who asks, how do you think TV animation is changing? Or, I guess, how did it change over the course of your time on Steven Universe?
That's a good question, Lincoln Prime. Let's see. What I actually think is kind of funny is that TV animation... It hasn't changed that much. It kind of has stayed very similar. The way we pitch the shows is very, like, I mean, you know, I work at Cartoon Network, which is basically, like, you know, built on top of Hanna-Barbera. And we basically pitch episodes and do things basically the same way that they did them. We get in a room, we talk about ideas, we pitch them to each other, we do what makes us laugh. I do think that, I don't know, like, there has been a trend towards, like, more creator-driven shows, but, I mean, that's kind of been happening since the 90s, so it's sort of like we're just kind of continuing the track that has been led before us. I think a thing that has maybe changed is just the way that the shows can... because everything gets to be a lot more specific, we can really dig into characters and, you know, do maybe stories that are a little deeper than, like, the cartoons of our youth. But, you know, the actual, like, process of doing it, I don't know, for me, it's very much the same.
Oh, got you. I think that one thing that comes to mind is, like, the way that the multi-platform thing, especially with KO, does it spread out so much over different?
I mean, yeah, but then on the other hand, I don't know. All the shows that I liked as a kid had toy lines and video games. You know, it's like we're kind of just, you know, we're doing the things that have always been done. It's just, you know, we're doing them with new stories and new characters. I think there's, you know, there's just some things that are well tested.
Okay, cool. Yeah. The next question is from Bubblegum Rebel, who asks, how do you find a decent balance between keeping fusion special and indulging the fans when it comes to new fusions? I mean, you can also just generalize that to, like, making reveals and timing them in a way that feels interesting.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things about when I was working on Steven Universe was that we had all these ideas of what to do, and... at the end of the day, we would just be like, we'd sit down and be like, what is the coolest way to unveil an idea? And we would basically, it was just like all, you know, rule of cool. It's like, you know, what's the most fun or interesting way that we can do something? And a lot of times, not even the most surprising way, just like the way that, you know, would feel good to us.
Rule of cool. I like that.
Yeah.
Anna Perloff asks if you have any fun facts about Opal.
Opal. I feel like a lot of the I feel like a lot of the facts about Opal are probably known. The thing, though, about Opal is that she's sort of deliberately mysterious because she's based on, you know, two people with different personalities. When they finally feel like they're on the same wavelength. And so that doesn't happen that much. So Opal is sort of designed to be like this temporary sort of existence. And I think one of the ideas we had about Opal was just that she's super because she's made only for like a specific use at a specific time between two people who can only get along for so long. She would just be very focused on a singular task and then probably not be very aware of other things that are going on around her, except for like the reason why she came into existence. So that's why we kind of ended up with the sort of thing where it's like, well, Opal is like, she's a little forgetful or maybe just a little like distracted at all times.
I really like that about her.
Yeah.
She's my favorite fusion, I think. Question from Joshua. When a character is introduced in their first few episodes, how do you set them up?
Oh, geez. I think that the easy way to do that is sort of, I think on a TV show, every character sort of needs kind of like their main sort of gimmick, the main thing that they're all about. And you just have to kind of find what animates them to do that, basically like, where do they get that from? Like, I would say, like, for instance, you know, we had the character of Onion on Steven very early, and we came up with all these crazy ideas. Like, Onion's this kid, he's kind of creepy, he like does all this weird stuff, and then, you know, but I think one of the things we had from very early was this idea that, oh well, Onion, maybe it's just because His dad is gone all the time, and so he's just, like, constantly getting into trouble and, like, doing weird things because there's no one around to tell him no. So that kind of became, like, one of the main things about him. And then in subsequent episodes, we would kind of lean on that idea as much as we could.
Right, so you don't necessarily have to introduce everything at once.
No, I don't think so. I feel like as long as you know it, there will be, like, a there will be an internal logic to the character, and then you can always reveal like their backstory and their motivations later.
Yeah, they've got layers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like onions. Cool. One last question I wanted to ask about Steewood Plavin Turboverse, which is something that Rebecca mentioned earlier on. Do you have anything more about that? Yeah.
I mean, okay, so to go way back, Steward Plavin Turboverse, basically, Rebecca and I came up with that like way back when we were doing the pilots for Lakewood Plaza Turbo and Steven Universe. And we had this dream that, oh, if they both became shows, we would do a crossover episode called Steward Plavin Turboverse, where instead of the characters crossing over, we would merge the two shows. And so you would have Kaven, Peanid, Radithist, and Mr. Garnet. And it would be like about them.
Well.
It would be about them like going on an adventure. The only thing, though, is that an idea like that is basically like almost impossible to make because the best thing about crossovers is that you can sort of reuse designs from either show and then put them together and reuse voice actors and stuff like that. Basically, we came up with a show that we would have to redesign the entire world, all the backgrounds. Yeah. We'd have to redesign every single character. We would have to recast everyone. It's basically like, I don't know, maybe if we like, I don't know, if we had like a year to work on it, we could come up with something, but it's
it was the
yeah.
Worst possible scenario.
Yeah. I mean, you know, hey, I'll never say never, but, you know, it's basically like, it's basically an impossible idea to make just because of how much labor goes into making a cartoon, since every single object, every single background, every single character, they all have to be designed by artists, and it takes a really long time to do all those things. So, yeah.
We can dream.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much again for talking to me.
Yeah, no problem. This is great.
Always fun to hear from Ian, and now Steven Universe creator Rebecca Sugar is ready to answer some questions too. So first up for you, Rebecca, is a question from A to Z Write. They want to know what the process is for coming up with plot devices and characters and stuff like that that feed into the overall plot, like stuff that will challenge characters specifically.
I mean, it's all very interconnected. I think that the show is so character-based, and the story is so character-based, so it's really hard to separate out the plot from the characters, and the things that draw the characters together and make them need each other are also directly related to the things that challenge them as people. Like, the way that Pearl completely idolizes Garnet is something that helps them function as a team, but is also a humongous problem, and then the reason that she's like that has a lot to do with her past and, you know, Amethyst's attitude towards everyone as she behaves a certain way, but is often just sort of covering up for a lot of insecurities that end up becoming problems in other episodes. I mean, it's all interconnected. I think that you really have to just sort of understand why they act the way that they act. And once you do, you can see what's drawing them together and also what's pulling them apart, because those things are always going to be coming from the same place, which is them, the way they are as people.
Okay, cool. All right, here's a question from an anonymous person who's asking what your favorite tropes and ideas are, like either as a writer or as a person who consumes media.
I mean, I guess, like, I love cartoony tropes, like silly old cartoon tropes that are really sort of one-dimensional and wacky. Because I love the thought of imbuing that with realism and complexity. I think that that's the thing that's the most fun to me. Like, I love the thought of, and this is something that Ian Jones-Cordy really got me into, because he likes these sort of really wacky cliches. And I would be sort of like, I wanted to make something, this was like back in college, I would be like, I want to make something that's so original. It's not like anything anyone else has ever seen ever. And then he would sort of talk about, oh, but you have all this material, these like stepping stones of stuff that people look at and instantly understand, like readable things. He's like, you can use that to communicate. Like, you can use cliches to take a step forward into something that is then not a cliche. Oh, I just got so excited about that. So I guess I'm saying the tropes I love are just tropes. That's not really an answer. I like tropes. Just classic, corny things.
All right, we have a question from Hartley Velvet. The question is, was Lars's character arc all planned from the start of the show, or was it something more recent?
Oh, that was planned. That is one of the oldest show ideas ever.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's like a document of like my first 10 episode ideas, and that's in there.
Wow.
It took us 130 episodes to, what number is it? 134 episodes to get to it. It would have been episode 2.
We're already out in space with Lars.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
I mean, there's the elements are different. It's not so much the space aspect of it, but Steven resurrecting him was a very, very, very early thought.
Oh, so that's a okay. So it wasn't supposed to take place in like space or anything, though.
Not necessarily. Not initially.
Interesting. So why did you want it to be Lars specifically?
I mean, Steven and Lars have always been, you know, counter to each other, even in the pilot. And I think Lars, as the show has gone on, it's become even and even more true. They are so opposed to each other. Lars is someone who just can't accept help, and Steven just wants to help everyone. That's what makes them have such a problem with each other. Lars is really putting on a facade all the time. Steven is, like, incapable of putting on a facade. They will always be. And, you know, Steven's relationship with the Gems has variations of that, but Lars is like this, just this counter to Steven and his whole attitude and his way. And they're just very, they're like, that opposition that they have to each other is one of the oldest things in the show, even back before its conception. And then Lars is a character that existed even before the show, because I was doing comic strips about Lars, like, in college.
Was it someone, like, you knew from then, or was it just, like, character you come...
Oh, like based on a person?
Yeah.
Lars and Sadie were kind of based off of me and other friends, sort of an amalgam of people I knew. And they were originally going to be, like, in those, they were people who were in college, who were sort of hanging out with each other because other people weren't interested in hanging out with them. my concept for it was really mundane. Like, it was just like, I just wanted to do comic strips where there like was no plot or point, like a comic strip of Sadie just making like boxed macaroni and cheese and sitting down and eating it. And there's like no punchline. It's just like what what the college experience was actually like. It's like really a lot of long stretches of just boring.
That's too real. Too real. I can speak to that.
Yeah. So when we were doing like, oh, it's going to be Steven and then it's going to be this magical world and then this real world, I was like, oh, them. Oh, they'll be representative of this real world. Because that was always sort of the point of those characters.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to me.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
The Steven Universe podcast is produced by Stacey Pera, Charles Abadje, and Conrad Montgomery. Special thanks to Rob Storcher, Cartoon Network Studios, The Crooniverse, and Turner Studios. And while this brings to a close the Steven Selects miniseries, we do have some special podcast episodes headed your way starting Tuesday, December 19th. So be sure to subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and please leave us a 5-star rating and review while you're there. And you can watch Steven Universe episodes on Cartoon Network or the Cartoon Network app. It's been a blast doing these deep dive episodes with the Crooniverse. I can't thank everyone enough for their time, insights, and creativity. I'm Mackenzie Atwood, and I will talk to you again December 19th.